From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. For the second time this week, the Supreme Court has dealt a major blow to President Trump, today blocking the administration's attempt to end DACA by a 5-4 majority.
Chief Justice John Roberts again siding with the court's liberals, upholding President Obama's Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, which stopped deportations for about 700,000 immigrants brought into this country illegally as young people before a certain date. The Trump administration tried to end DACA in 2017, but today the court said the move was arbitrary and capricious, and in effect that they did it in the wrong way. President Trump shot back on Twitter, calling the decision horrible and politically charged. Dahlia Lithwick, who covers courts and the law for Slate and hosts the podcast Amicus. Dahlia, the court ruled that the Department of Homeland Security violated the Administrative Procedure Act when it ordered the end of DACA at the request of former Attorney General Jeff Sessions. That's what I meant when I said they did it wrong. Could you put that in more eloquent language? What was the court's reasoning?
Robin, I think they did it wrong captures it perfectly, actually. It essentially means that you can't do shoddy legal work when you rescind DACA. And the ruling essentially said that the government, the Department of Homeland Security, just failed to justify why they were ending the program. They didn't take into consideration the effects it would have to rescind DACA. And Chief Justice Roberts was very clear to say we did not decide whether DACA is a sound policy or whether the rescission is a sound policy. But the agency didn't comply with the hoops they needed to go through to rescind it, and therefore the whole thing is unlawful.
Well, we're hearing your fellow legal minds say that the court, in its decision, laid out how to do it the right way. So what does this mean for the approximately 700,000 DACA recipients? Is there still a way for the Trump administration to go back at this?
That's exactly right. This was by no means a decision on the merits. As I said, the chief did not jump in and say DACA is unlawful on its merits. It, in some sense, created a roadmap and said, if DHS really wants to do this, these are the correct hoops. Dot your I's, cross your T's, and come back and see us when you've done it correctly. So it does mean that those 700,000 dreamers are certainly safe from deportation imminently, but it doesn't give them the kind of constitutional backstop that says the whole thing could never have been done lawfully.
Of course, we'll talk about the politics of this elsewhere. You know, President Trump would probably have to win re-election to have the time to do that. But the court's other conservative justices outside of Roberts dissented from the majority. What did they say?
They dissented essentially saying that the court doesn't get to decide why an agency does what it does or how it does what it does. Clarence Thomas, writing for most of the dissenters, said the decision to countermand an unlawful agency action is clearly reasonable so long as the agency's determination of illegality is sound. Our review should be at an end. In other words, not our place to ask how they did it. They did it. That's the end of the story.
Yeah. And as we said, Chief Justice Roberts sides with the liberal justices here in this 5-4 decision. He and Justice Gorsuch also joined them in Monday's landmark ruling that granted protections to LGBTQ workers. We're hearing, don't interpret this as John Roberts has suddenly become a liberal. What, in your mind, is the significance of his rulings, his record?
It has been a fascinating week, Robin. He seems to be the new Anthony Kennedy, maybe more Anthony Kennedy than the old Anthony Kennedy, insofar as he has thrown in with the liberal justices on two of the most consequential cases this term. I think we have a bunch more cases coming down at us, and we'll see what happens. But it is very, very clear that he is not the doctrinaire Federalist Society John Roberts we all believed him to be. He is most certainly in play.
Could he be looking also to history and to public opinion?
I think a little bit, and I think this case to me sounds in the key of last year's census case, where he said, look, I may not disagree with your motives here, but don't give me shoddy, sloppy lawyering and ask me to cover for you. So I think in a little bit of a sense, this is an easy case for him because it was just handled so poorly in the Trump administration. Huh. On both this and on the Title VII cases, I do think he's a little bit looking to be on the right side of history.
Dahlia Lithwick, her podcast Amicus. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, the Labor Department said today that another 1.5 million people filed for unemployment last week, bringing the total to nearly 46 million in the last 13 weeks. We're joined now by former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers. Welcome back.
Glad to be with you, Jeremy.
Well, and some people are starting to go back to work as businesses reopen. The number filing for unemployment is going down, although it's still high. Are you seeing some signs of hope in the numbers we're seeing in the recent jump in retail sales, or what's your assessment of what we're in for right now?
Better than I probably would have guessed 3 or 4 weeks ago, but I think it's more that the bounce back we knew would come has come a little faster than we expected, than it is that there's a profound change in where we're headed. The basic conclusion driving an economic view that we're still going to be substantially short of normal until we get a vaccine. I haven't seen anything that causes me to change my mind about that. The retail sales number was a particularly striking number, Jeremy, because in most every respect, we've all been saying that this crisis is much worse than the 2008 financial crisis. But as of now, retail sales are only down between half and two-thirds as much as they were in 2008. So it does represent some kind of return towards at least the normal range of crisis.
Well, how much more federal assistance do you think is going to be needed, and what should Congress do now?
Congress should urgently support state and local governments. Congress should urgently appropriate at least 2% of all the money it appropriates for testing and contact tracing. Congress should refashion the expanded unemployment insurance to invest more in administering a program that works rather than simply extending high benefit levels for a lucky few. And Congress should oversee the business support programs to make sure that the taxpayers are getting the right value for money in terms of claims on the upside when taxpayers are providing support on the downside.
Well, when you say reform unemployment, what do you mean by that specifically?
I mean making sure that if somebody works half-time, they can get a half unemployment benefit. I mean appropriating enough money so that here in the 21st century, we have the IT systems that enable everybody who's eligible to get their application through and start receiving the benefits they urgently need. I mean adjusting eligibility rules so that people who were previously self-employed or who were previously in the gig economy are able to get the unemployment insurance they need.
What about the Fed, which has taken extraordinary steps to prop up the economy? This week, it announced it will start buying individual corporate bonds. Is the Fed getting it right?
The most important lesson of financial crisis is that there is more risk of underreacting than there is of overreacting. And Jay Powell and the Fed have heeded that lesson. I do think we need to think a little bit more about people's capitalism rather than capitalists' capitalism. But overall, I would give the Fed high marks.
Let me ask you one more thing and have you put your former president of Harvard hat on. Universities around this country are trying to figure out what to do. They're looking at dramatically falling revenues from tuition, from room and board. They are trying to get things open in the fall. The professors are worried that they're going to be putting themselves at risk if they go into the classroom. What would your advice be to universities, large and small around this country, should they push to open this fall?
Yeah, I think there's a famous phrase that the Supreme Court used in a very different educational context, all deliberate speed. You have to start with the basic trump, which is health and safety. And you need to recognize that a college dormitory is a lot like a cruise ship. And we know that cruise ships are dangerous and there's risks of the same kind with respect to college dorms. It seems incredibly important right now to be back in September rather than back a few months later. I'm not sure in 3 years those few months are going to look quite as important as they do right now. And if this contributes to setting off a second wave, that's going to be a very substantial danger. So I am worried about people overdoing it in terms of speed.
That is Larry Summers, former president of Harvard University, former Treasury Secretary, and former director of the National Economic Council. Thank you so much, as always, for joining us.
Thanks.
We've heard the stories. We've reported them here. How COVID-19 is good for the environment. Clean air in Los Angeles without traffic. More wildflowers and bees in the UK. Crystal clear waters in the canals of Venice. Evidence, right, that the new coronavirus shutdowns have saved nature. And then we've gone on to report that this is just a temporary save. But our next guest says it's even worse, that COVID-19 may actually be hurting the environment, in that while we look the other way, there's deforestation, illegal mining, wildlife poaching, land grabbing. Those last two, the destruction of wild habitat and the sale of wild animals who often end up in those so-called wet markets, are thought to have caused the new coronavirus outbreak. Colorado State University professor Edward Barbier, whose recent article on the World Economic Forum website is titled "The COVID-19 Pandemic is Not a Break for Nature. Let's Make Sure There Is One, a Break After This Crisis." His co-authors include Costa Rica's Minister of Environment. He joins us now from Colorado. Professor Barbier, Ed, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
So we know that there's a short-term benefit. You know, the International Energy Agency says the world will use 6% less energy this year. That's the largest reduction in 70 years. But that's not going to make up for these other losses that you list. Start there. You write, in rural areas, nature is kind of a savings account for people. They live off it. They make withdrawals, you know, for food when they go hunting and fishing, for land when they grow food or build. What is happening in those areas?
Well, two things are happening in rural tropical areas. The first is that with the pandemic and then the lockdowns, a lot of people who migrated from rural areas to the urban areas of developing countries are now flocking back to rural communities where they came from. As a result, as you described, they then go back to using nature more intensively. They don't have employment or income, and so they want to use the land. They want to perhaps harvest wildlife. They possibly also engage in some illegal activities. This is leading to tremendous pressure unexpectedly. But perhaps the more overwhelming problem is not from these people, but from illegal actors basically taking advantage of the governments being focused on COVID and not protecting tropical areas and remote regions, and going in a big way with mining, with agricultural development, and certainly converting a lot of forests and burning it.
So this is a huge movement to this illegal mining or poaching. And then the groups that usually defend these areas, conservation groups, because of the lack of tourism, you remind us, these groups don't have the resources that they once had to fight those bad actors.
That's right. And also restrictions on travel and operations. And of course, isolation means that they can't actually operate in these areas legally, of course, to monitor what's going on.
You mentioned Kenya, the Galapagos, the World Heritage Sites. They're not getting protected because there's just not the tourism dollars to fund that. And remind us, we've spoken about how, you know, one action somewhere has these unintended consequences. So when people destroy natural habitats by building or logging, the creatures that live there, like bats, are forced closer and closer to humans or other animals. And suddenly you have these zoonotic diseases, diseases that might pass from animals to humans.
That's absolutely right. And in fact, the two main drivers of disease transmission from wildlife to people are wildlife trade and exploitation, and also land use change. Because we destroy the habitats, or the habitats become degraded and much smaller, that increases the chance of contact between humans and wildlife. And of course, when you exploit, trade, and consume wildlife, then you become more in contact with them. And so there is a double danger here. Not only are we impacting rural livelihoods of local communities by destroying tropical forests and other ecosystems, but we're actually increasing possibly the risk of future disease transmission from wildlife to people.
And even though you can connect the dots, you can tell world leaders, there will be more pandemics just like this if we don't do something about climate change. This is a natural fallout. We told you, we predicted that this was going to happen. It feels as if it's going to be hard to get people to focus attention and dollars with an economic crisis on,
yes,
you know, the climate and the environment.
Yes, exactly. However, I think there are some positive signs here. First of all, even before the pandemic, the IPCC and others had pointed out that land use change is contributing to about a quarter of global emissions. So already there was a movement globally to consider land use change and how do we control it as an important part of our global climate strategy. Secondly, we're having more and more studies show that what's called natural climate solutions, protecting, restoring, and managing ecosystems, forests, and land is essential and relatively cost effective to reducing climate emissions. And then thirdly, I think there is growing recognition of this problem that nature is not getting a break from the pandemic in rural tropical areas. And in this area, I would like to see personally more of the fiscal stimulus that's being spent for emergency relief going to help poor countries that are affected by an uptake in tropical deforestation and land use change to help them protect their areas from illegal exploitation.
Now, things like mangroves, tropical forests, peatlands, other ecosystems, spend the money there. Tell me one thing for people who are, you know, worried maybe they've seen an elderly relative die alone in a nursing home because of a virus they never heard of before. We also have huge eruption of racial issues in the U.S., but people around the world responding to this. You know, when maybe Blacks, African Americans are thinking, I got to worry about whether or not I'm going to die because I might have had a small infraction and a police officer is going to kill me. How do you convey that the global warming, the climate change is equally important?
I think the answer is that increasingly we're becoming aware that climate change does not affect all people equally. If you are poor, if you're vulnerable, if you're subject to discrimination, if you are forced into crowded areas, you get the worst pollution, you get the worst hazards. And in both urban and rural areas, you suffer from drought, from flood at risk if your cities are close to the ocean. So increasingly, we're seeing that the burden of climate change, just like this burden of the pandemic, is increasingly falling on the poorest, the most vulnerable of society, and the elderly. And these are the people who are affected in the pandemic disproportionately. And we're seeing that climate change risks and other global environmental risks also fall on these vulnerable groups around the world. And so when people in their own rooms and houses see that their family members are being affected and that the unemployment consequences and the income losses that they're experiencing, the same thing is being felt by somebody in New Delhi or in the jungles of Brazil, being exposed to all these pressures, climate change, biodiversity loss, and of course, now the pandemic.
That's Colorado State University Professor Edward Barbier. We'll link you to his writing on how COVID-19 is not good for nature in the long run at herenow.org. Professor Barbier, Ed, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
Well, there was emotional testimony yesterday in the Butte County courtroom in Northern California as families of victims of the campfire, which nearly destroyed the town of Paradise in 2018, confronted officials of the utility PG&E just a day after PG&E pled guilty to 84 counts of manslaughter. Among those who died was Andrew Downer. His brother Joseph recalled the last time they spoke the day of the fire.
That's what wakes me up at night, the sounds of the exploding things that were in the phone when I talked to my brother. I've literally got up in the middle of the night, threw my daughter over my shoulder and ran out the house thinking the house was on fire. I'm on antidepressant meds. I've had to deal with my little daughter who loved her Uncle Andy wake up in the middle of the night screaming thinking she's in the house with my brother burning. So, you know, this whole event's been super tragic. I have a son who in fact turns 2 next week. I remember how proud I was when I called my brother and said, hey, I'm having a son. And he goes, cool. And I said, I want to name him after you. This is my big brother. This is the guy who taught me so much in life, to be a man, to stand on my feet, to do the right thing. And PG&E took all this from me, all of it.
PG&E has admitted its outdated equipment started the campfire, but because it's a corporation, no one will go to jail. Skye Sedgwick lost her father, John, in the fire. She talked to our colleague, Tanya Mosley, about that a year ago. Yesterday, she blasted what she called PG&E's culture of greed.
It's true that this company will serve no prison time, and it's impossible to truly hold the people responsible for the oversight and neglect of PG&E's equipment. However, unless you sit before me today without a conscience, if you do not change that culture and more die as a result, then their blood is on your hands. And this, there is a court bigger than this. You can call that court karma or judgment day or whatever you subscribe to. Maybe it will be a guilty conscience, again, provided you have one. To know you could have prevented the music from dying, or a man's legacy going up in smoke, or robbing a man of his retirement, or creating a void in a family that can never be refilled because their father, their grandfather, their uncle, or brother died trying to save his home from fire.
Tom LeBlanc, who lost his stepdaughter, Kimber Ware, and his home in the campfire, said this to the judge.
You leave this courtroom, Your Honor, as a victim, because I have been scarred for life. If they feel just a little bit of pain today from my story, mission accomplished.
Voices of those forever changed by the campfire. Protests around the world have led to dramatic confrontations between civilians and police, but there have also been many moments of understanding. Colorado Public Radio's Stina Sieg reports from Grand Junction, where two unlikely allies have started a conversation about police violence.
Stay strong, guys.
On a hot and sunny afternoon, more than 50 young demonstrators marched through the small city's downtown. The crowd includes several players from Colorado Mesa University's football team. And toward the back, their coach, Tremaine Jackson, who's black, says they're here to stand up for George Floyd and also stand up against the racism they experience in this community.
This issue is something that I live with daily. I just happen to be the head football coach here. And so we're not going to run from the issues at all. We just want to address it. Make sure it's acknowledged and form a plan to move on.
As the group continues down Main Street, they get some stares, but also encouragement from passersby.
Good for you. Keep going.
They're headed for the Grand Junction police station, not for a conflict, but to meet with a man Coach Jackson has already been talking with.
We're planning on kind of setting an example and addressing some of the issues that we need to address, quite frankly.
Police Chief Doug Shoemaker is white. Jackson reached out to him after the chief wrote a long thread of tweets condemning Floyd's death.
So we're going to do that as a team, one team. And I think once we start respecting the rights of one another and we start talking about those things openly, maybe we can be an example for other places.
Inside the police station, things quickly go from united to more complex as Chief Shoemaker takes questions from the crowd. One young man says he's personally seen injustice from Grand Junction Police.
I need action. I don't want to talk.
And he questions why it took a tragedy to address the issues he believes are in the department.
How long have you been on the staff? We could have been talking.
We could have been talking, he says.
Let's go.
Okay.
Then walks out, a small group following him. Coach Jackson tells his players to stay put, but others in the room are still frustrated.
I'm saying he's going to acknowledge that there's a problem.
We know that.
Chief, have you acknowledged that there's a problem?
A big problem. Thank you.
He's acknowledged it.
Thank you.
And I think that's what we need, man.
Chief Shoemaker tells the group that one way they can make a difference is to join his department themselves.
Seriously, it's an open application process all year round.
Then one of the young protesters walks up to the chief and shakes his hand.
I don't know what the plan is.
but this is the first step.
Chief Shoemaker asks him and everyone else in the crowded lobby to hold him accountable for making his department better.
Give us some time. This is not an overnight thing. This is a marathon, not a sprint. But my pledge to you on film, and even on our own department film, is that hold me accountable.
That includes Coach Jackson, who says the two of them are going to start having regular talks about shifting the culture of racism.
We're going to meet as many times as we need to meet in order to make change.
For Here and Now, I'm Stina Sieg in Grand Junction, Colorado.
And a passing to note, Dame Vera Lynn's voice helped raise the morale of British troops during World War II.
We'll meet again, don't know where. Don't know when, but I know we'll meet again.
That memory is strong. Earlier this year, Queen Elizabeth referenced this song when she spoke to Britons separated by the coronavirus lockdown. Dame Vera died early today at 103.
Aside from today's Supreme Court decision, there's a lot going on in Washington, from former National Security Advisor John Bolton's new book to action in Congress on police reform to unemployment and COVID-19. Let's get to all of it with Republican Senator Rick Scott of Florida, who joins us now. Welcome back.
It's nice to be back, Jeremy.
I want to start just by asking you about the news of the day. Former National Security Advisor John Bolton alleging in his upcoming book that President Trump asked the Chinese President Xi Jinping to help him with his upcoming election. What was your reaction to that, and should that be investigated?
Well, first off, I've not known John Bolton a long time, but my experience with him has been positive. I haven't seen the book, so I don't know any facts in the book, and I clearly wasn't there when any of these things happened. So, I think, like on everything, let's get the facts out there. I don't know how, the way to do it. And I do know that she is the general secretary of a communist party and is a dictator and human rights violator, but it's always best to get the facts out. And this isn't a Republican or Democrat issue. I just don't think people ought to go work for a president, any president, and to go to these tell-all books. I mean, I just think, I don't think it's the right thing to do.
Well, let me just ask you one more thing about it, though, because I know that you have spoken out strongly against the Chinese crackdown on the Uyghurs. You've even called for the 2022 Olympics to be pulled out of Beijing if they don't stop the abuse of Uyghurs. And one of the allegations in this book is Bolton said that President Trump told President Xi to go ahead with these concentration camps. Shouldn't the president have opposed that idea privately, if not publicly, exposing to the world what Xi apparently was doing, given that, as you've said, this is a major human rights violation?
Yeah, I think of every American president has got to stand up for our freedoms. We know that, General Secretary Xi doesn't believe in that, doesn't believe in human rights. I think every American president's got to stand up for freedom and liberty and democracy, and with the goal that every person in the entire world has the same sort of Bill of Rights that we have. But, of course, I wasn't there. So I hope that every president stands up against what they're doing to the Uyghurs.
Let's talk about policing. Senate Republicans released a bill yesterday. It does have some differences with the changes that House Democrats are proposing. There's a looser ban, for example, than the House Democrats are proposing on chokeholds and on no-knock warrants, which is the kind of warrant that led to Breonna Taylor's death. The Democratic bill bans those warrants in federal drug cases and incentivizes police departments to do the same. The Republican bill just requires data collection. Why not a ban on no-knock warrants?
First off, I'm glad that we're having this conversation, right? I think we've got to say we don't ever want something to happen like what happened to George Floyd. It was disgusting, and everybody I talked to in law enforcement. So here's what I'm doing. I'm talking to the sheriffs. I'm talking to the police chiefs. I'm talking to the police unions and say, okay, so give me your thoughts on these things. Somebody from outside, you say, why would you ever have to do things like a no-knock warrant, and there's these issues about body cameras, there's issues about chokeholds, all these things. So what I'm doing is I'm getting the facts from the people that deal with it every day. And when you look at what happened to George Floyd, we clearly see there's bad actors. I've had a very positive working relationship with our sheriffs and police chiefs. When I left as governor, I think Florida was in a 47 or 48 year low in our crime rate. I want every community to be safe, and I want law enforcement to do their job and be respected.
Are you optimistic that Republicans in the Senate, Democrats in the House are going to be able to get together to get something big past? Are you optimistic that will happen?
Yeah, Jimmy, I actually am on this. Look, if there's going to continue where the Democrats are talking about defunding the police, and then that's clearly not going to happen. Republicans are not going to be there. We've got to have law enforcement. We have to have accountable law enforcement. So hopefully that's not where the Democrats end up. But yeah, I'm optimistic. I think what I want is I want accountability. If you want to help everybody in your community, then you say, how does everybody get a job? Not like for a percentage, just a small percentage of some. You got to do it for everybody. And then I talk to people all the time. They want to live wherever they live. They don't like to move around. They like their friends and their family, but they want to be safe. I lived in public housing. Everybody I was around, they wanted to be safe. And so let's make it safe for everybody.
Let's turn to COVID-19. Florida set a record this week for the daily number of new cases. There's a rise in hospitalizations. More than 3,000 people have died. And some experts are saying Florida has all the markings of the next large epicenter of coronavirus transmissions. Do you think Florida officials are letting their guard down a little too soon, allowing things to reopen too quickly?
You hope not, right? You know, but my family's been very, very, very cautious about, you know, what we're doing. But I hope everybody is wearing masks, social distancing, and getting tested. There's more tests. Are there enough COVID tests? No, there's not enough COVID tests yet. I know our healthcare community is focused on making sure they're ready if there is. And you know, just you hope that if we all take this seriously, we'll figure out how to stop this. I'm optimistic we funded the vaccine. Unfortunately, it's not going to happen today, but hopefully we will have a vaccine. We'll have a vaccine quickly. That's when we're going to finally get back to a normal life again. But you sure hope people keep taking this seriously. I don't want anybody to get sick.
Well, we did see 16 Florida friends test positive for the virus after a night out at a bar in Jacksonville. And we know the Republican National Convention, President Trump's going to be accepting the nomination in front of a crowd in Jacksonville. Are you worried about that? Do you think that Jacksonville is going to be able to safely host tens of thousands of people indoors in 2 months?
They have to. I mean, they have to. Look, I'm glad the convention's in Florida, but you got to do it safely. They're going to have to social distance. They're going to have to wear masks. They're going to have to do everything they can. Hopefully by then, you know, maybe there'll be enough tests out there that people can be tested. I don't know what they're going to do, but they have to do this safely. We cannot have another outbreak of this. We don't want to shut down our economy again. So we got to figure out how to sort of do both. Open our economy, try to get back to normal, but do it safely.
Well, on the economic front, we got another report today about unemployment claims. More than a million people filed for that. The extra unemployment funding that Congress passed is going to expire next month, even with unemployment still above 13%. Would you consider extending that, the expanded unemployment benefits?
Well, here's what I think. We've got to take care of the people that have lost their job, but we can't do it in a manner that our small businesses don't get reopened because they don't have their employees. So you can't pay people more to not work than to work. That doesn't make any sense. But you want to make sure people can survive while we get this economy open again. So you got to figure out how to do this. You know, we've got another, 5 weeks or so to try to figure this out. You know, I'm going to be very active in trying to make sure that we take care of those unemployed. What I don't want to do is I don't want Florida taxpayers to bail out New York or other states that didn't fund their pensions, have dramatically bigger budgets. You know, they don't ever hold anybody account. They don't watch their money. So, but we got to take care of our small businesses, and we have to take care of the people that have lost their jobs.
But do you expect another big relief package out of Congress?
I think what we'll do is we're going to have a focus on how do we make sure we have liability protection for our first responders, you know, our healthcare workers and our small business. I think that's going to be in there. I think we're going to focus on how do you make sure you take the people unemployed and whatever relief we need to continue to help our small business. I think that will be in there. So, you know, we've got a few weeks to go to see what's happening, and then we can figure this out. I think this will happen. If it happens, Jeremy, it's going to happen the last 2 weeks of July.
Uh-huh. Let me ask you one more thing, Senator, while we have you.
Sure.
And I actually spoke with a journalist at WMFE in Orlando, the NPR station there, and asked what they would want to know. So we got the big news out of the Supreme Court this week, giving LGBTQ people protection from employment discrimination. And the question to you is, should Florida enact a statewide law protecting LGBTQ people from workplace discrimination?
Well, first off, I'm against any form of discrimination, so I support the decision by the court. I think that we've got to make sure that people are not discriminated against, and so we'll see if there's something else we need. But we cannot have people being discriminated in any way at all. So I support what the court did. You know, Jeremy, people want to go complain about the courts making these decisions, but it's because the legislative bodies don't do their job and they don't have these conversations. And so, you know, I support what the Supreme Court did.
That is Republican Senator Rick Scott of Florida. Senator, thank you so much again for joining us and taking all of our questions today.
Here, Jeremy.
And by the way, apparently President Trump doesn't agree with Senator Scott on the Supreme Court decision involving LGBTQ rights. He tweeted today that this week's court decisions were like shotgun blasts into the faces of people who are proud to call themselves Republicans or conservatives. I guess not all of them.
The gradual return of sports shut down by the pandemic is colliding with protests sparked by police killings of black men and women. Yesterday, players from England's Premier Soccer League kneeled to support the Black Lives Matter movement when their season resumed. And when high school sports resumed in Iowa this week, the entire Roosevelt High School baseball team took a knee during the national anthem. Also yesterday, in an interview with Scott Thuman of Sinclair Broadcasting, President Trump said Colin Kaepernick, the quarterback who started the anthem protest 3 years ago and hasn't played since, should get another shot at the NFL, even though the president had previously called Kaepernick and others who kneel, well, it's a phrase that insults your mother. And yesterday he also said this.
I don't want to kneel. I don't want to see people kneel for the national anthem, for the American flag. You stand. Be proud. Put your hand on your heart.
Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, let's outline. Police officers in Minneapolis and Atlanta charged with murdering black men. Athletes protesting. The president still speaking out against kneeling, even when some sympathetic cops are taking a knee. Oh, and by the way, while, you know, football says it sides with Black Lives Matter, Colin Kaepernick has not been hired back. Discuss.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think of John Bolton's phrase that came out, the archipelago of dots that describes Donald Trump's thinking process. So it does seem like there are other issues and maybe other tacks to take. He has been consistent in weighing in that kneeling is just unacceptable in his mind. On the other hand, he's been consistent. And so he says Kaepernick should get a job. He echoed that in an interview he did with Sean Hannity. He says if Kaepernick is able to get a job, he should get a job, which sort of whistles past the background condition that you hinted at. You know, he's not being offered a job, even though at least when he last played, he was an above average quarterback. So it all adds up to Donald Trump thinking this is still a good issue for him, or at least the best spin that he could put on an issue where we can find no other public figure who is echoing those sentiments. Drew Brees said something similar to that, as we talked about last week, Robin. I respect the flag. I want to stand. And then he had a call with people who were important to him, and he backtracked on those comments. But of course, President Trump is just jutting out his chin and not backtracking at all.
Well, let's talk about other players. Basketball star Kyrie Irving says the NBA's return will detract from the movement against racial injustice. You know, other athletes and performers are also saying things like, you like our culture, but you don't want me on your street. And they're not just talking to police, they're talking to their fans. So first, one wonders what happens when they're all back in an arena together, the players, the fans. But to Irving's comments, more about what he said, and how will it impact the NBA's plan to restart the season next month, every team playing at the Disney World campus in Florida?
Right. And in even less time than that, the sort of pre-quarantine would begin. Now, what we should know about Kyrie Irving is he's a great player. He's the vice president of the Players Association, but he's also out for the season with an injury. So he wouldn't be participating in any case. But he has gotten on calls with other players in the NBA who are not comfortable with this plan going forward, this bubble plan to invite most of the teams and have a quasi-playoff leading to a playoff format. Now, what others, LeBron James among them, say and argue is that actually us playing would get attention to the causes that like Black Lives Matter. And not playing and not being in the public eye would actually hurt that. But then there is sort of a middle path. In fact, I think LeBron probably represents the middle path, which is something like, we're not going to compel anyone to come inside this bubble. So if there are people for political reasons, for health reasons, for any reason at all, don't want to come, we're going to work out so that they won't be punished by their teams. But we also want to create a format where the players can play and they can play safely and they can also get attention for their issues. So there is a little bit of tension there. And I think Kyrie Irving is voicing a concern that a lot of players have, but I don't know if it's enough of the concern. I don't think it is to scuttle the entire plan.
Yeah. When you look at football, they weren't thinking about coming back till September, but now they have several players testing positive for COVID-19 on different teams. And what about baseball? They were, you know, thinking of starting a season, but owners and players can't reach an agreement there.
Yes. So on the football part, Anthony Fauci was on CNN saying that he recommends the same sort of bubble that basketball and baseball are thinking of. Football cannot just blithely say, oh, the coronavirus will take care of itself and we're going to proceed as normal. And as far as baseball, I don't know if it was ever unlikely that the season would happen, but it was at least getting close to unlikely. I mean, owners and players were just at each other's throats, but the head of the union and the commissioner of baseball did meet, and maybe now there is light, and it seems like they could come back with a 60-game schedule. Very important. The players wanted their salaries prorated. No discount. They just, if they play 60 games, then they would get essentially, you know, about a little less than half of their salary, and that's what they want. And I think that's what they're going to get.
Okay. Oh, what a moment. Mike Pesca, here now, is a sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.